This is the real weepy and like tragic part of the story beginning, oh my brothers and only friends.
I'm in for four potential getaway drivers. Go.
No!
But I was told that I could listen to the radio at a reasonable volume.
No!
Excuse me, we have a little bit of a hurry.
Hang on, Voltaire.
It's yet another long series of diversions in an attempt to avoid responsibility.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have tragic news for you. On this day, the year of our Lord, 2006, the means is announcing its death. It has finally succumbed to an ailment because of this fucking bullshit Quebecer world. Our publisher can't publish a goddamn book correctly. So, and now they're giving us shit for it, as though it's our fault, as though books have never been published without gloss on the cover. And all of a sudden, we are now a hang-up in their system, and they don't want us to be causing this type of a distraction when they got better shit to print, apparently. But here's the take on it. Here's what happened. I received my shipment of books. Already seen this, but I received my shipment of books. Tanner's was being sent out to him. I got mine first, opened them up, noticed that pretty much every fucking copy of this issue has bleeding on it. Has this it looks like rust. It looks like someone took like a reddish orange crayon and put it all up and down vertically on the spine, and every so often bleeding off of pictures. That's unacceptable. We here at The Means believe that we have a solid product, and the last thing we want to do, and this isn't salesmanship because we're not making a fucking dime on this, obviously, but we don't want to give you guys a shoddy product. We intended for this to be a very pristine pink cover, and if we are going to get rust color red on the sides of it, that's not our style, and we're not going to do it. So I sent back six sample copies, and the lady on the phone was more than amicable. She said, yes, send them in, and we will get this corrected. Well, turns out Tanner's shipment, which should have reached him two Fridays ago, I believe, maybe last. Either way, his shipment should have arrived, and yeah, it arrived in California, but it certainly did not arrive in Corona, California, where he lives. It arrived in fucking Riverside, where he once lived at one time, and lucky there's an honest apartment manager over there in Riverside who sent those back to Quebecer World for us, because we would have had to foot the expense to do that. But that's wonderful, the guy sent it back. However, Quebecer World doesn't take that opinion. In their mind, this has all been a burden on them, and so this has just been, we're somehow taking up their time right now, and they haven't gotten back to us. Tell you the truth, I don't know if they're going to reprint these for us right now. They should, and if they don't, then they're going to receive a summons from our lawyer, who has yet to be named. There will be a draft, though, and we'll figure out who that will be. But we'll see what happens. To be honest, how far this has escalated into, if there's going to be a problem with it. All I know is that Quebecer's response to us was, well, you should have gotten it glossed the way we wanted it, or the way that they told us to do it. But our contention is, I've picked up a million books that have the same cover type as what we've got, and not once have I said, oh, there's bleeding. Must just be the way things get printed. That's not how it works, and we will not deliver a shit product to you. So give us time. I've got bad copies. Email us if you just want the bad copy. If you're all about this coming to you in a timely fashion, if punctuality is your thing, fine. Send me an email, and I will send you one of the copies. I'll pick out the best of the shitty.
Yes, the collector's item variant bad cover issues that I'm sure will be going for a ton of money in your local card shops next to rookie cards of Cecil Fielder.
Your Wade Boggs 1986 Boston rookie card will certainly have a contention. There'll be a contender in your with this issue. But regardless, just sucks because we've already been delaying this, and we knew it, and so we've got all these grand designs to bring out this issue 2.5, but now there's this whole other factor of, do we go with Quebecer World, or do we hedge our bets and try and find someone new? Now, Tanner, you mentioned that there was a printer somewhere else in the world that is willing
to
do
it.
Yeah,
we've got a few people we're preparing to bring out of the minor leagues. So we're not sweating it either.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just confirmed that issue 2.5 will have a cover done by the same woman who just did the best American comics issue for Houghton Mifflin.
Houghton Mifflin is big time.
Yeah, so she did the cover for that, and she's now doing the cover for us because we're just that sexy.
Yeah. In other news, you can also buy our book with a different cover slapped on it by Jeffrey Brown. New cover that we had from the first issue, which is fine. We have no agreement with them. I'm just saying, apparently, if side-by-side on a shelf, you were like, I'm coming in to buy the means, you might mistakenly buy Jeffrey Brown's new compilation. Which is great, though. I mean, hey, look, if you accidentally choose the wrong one, I will fully guarantee you that you will enjoy whichever mistake you make. But still, it's just kind of funny. You know, he did, out of all the artwork he's ever done, that obviously was his best.
Yeah.
So maybe we should be proud.
All right, so let's move on to the first topic we had planned, which was, I just wanted to continue a conversation we were having off the podcast about strip clubs. And I sort of clarified my opinion on them, because I've been to a strip club maybe three times in my life, three or four times. You know what? And I started off in the opinion that they're completely harmless. You know, and that in some ways, perhaps, they're even sort of empowering for the strippers. But I've sort of modified my opinion now that I've been to a few of them. And you know, there's always two sides of the debate. People who demonize them, and then people who glorify them, you know. And I think the reality is probably in the middle there. And that's sort of what I wanted to talk about. It's just my take on the strip club and what it means, sort of, I guess, to women. I guess would be my perspective. And the way I see it is, sure, in some ways, the act of stripping and getting paid by men for it is sort of empowering, in that you're taking, you know, sexuality, which has historically sort of been, you know, dominated by men, and women's sexuality has always been under lock and key, you know, through men. You know, taking that sexuality, stripping, and then getting money from men for it is, I guess, a sort of Pyrrhic victory. But it's the idea of sort of the sexual economy that goes on within a strip club, I think, is ultimately pretty unproductive. And it still doesn't upset the power dynamic enough to make it an empowering environment. And the way I say this is because women are still, when they're stripping for men's money, not only for lap dances, but just for getting bucks while on stage. And while doing that, they're having to manipulate their sexuality in a way that is fulfilling men's desires in such a direct fashion that they are looking to do things that will get men's money immediately, on the spot. You know, what do I got to do? And if anyone who's ever been to a strip club knows, there's the predominant attitude within a strip club, and the guys are in there, there's a complete disrespect for the women. And they feel like they're owed certain sexual gifts from women while they're in the strip club. And if, you know, that girl's not responding well to them or whatever, she's a bitch or a hoe or a slut. And it's completely about judging and commodifying the female body in terms of a sexuality that is completely based around a man's fantasies and desire, And I concluded that this was sort of unproductive because it's not revising the power dynamic. It's keeping it intact, but meanwhile maybe making a few bucks out of it. So always the woman is sort of subservient to the man. Sure, there's bouncers who can kick guys out, but she is doing the man's bidding when she's up on stage trying to get his money, you know, still keeping that sort of even a monetary power dynamic in place. But I mentioned to Chris how the burlesque show is more productive because it upsets this. When someone goes to a burlesque show, they pay to get in, but they're not in a sort of sense of a direct monetary exchange for sexual favors from a woman. You pay to get in, then you watch a theatrical performance that is, and most importantly, is sort of taking a man's desires, playing on a man's desires by showing a little skin, but never fulfilling them in a way that would be satisfying traditionally. And I think that's the big difference between a strip club and a burlesque club, is the burlesque club is revising the expectations of a man and never completely fulfilling them. And I think that's the important difference.
And I think another major difference, too, if I hope I'm not cutting you off. If you had more to say, go ahead if you need to. Okay. The other important thing, too, is that what a burlesque show does, because I'm in total concurrence with you, when we had this discussion about 5 days ago or so, I've been to both burlesque shows and strip clubs, and with burlesque shows, what I find most intriguing is that they don't in any way play... See, what they do is they take not the man's fantasy, but a traditional role of a woman is within the household, behind closed doors, and then they kind of manipulate it so that you're attracted to it, or maybe you find it bizarre in some way, whereas when you go to a strip club... What they're commodifying really is your fantasy. It's taking you to the utmost sexual deviance. It's taking you to that level where it's like this woman is open and available to you, and
yeah, then she's a purely sexual object, nothing else, and she's doing the man what the man wants at all times.
Exactly, and of course, yeah, there are those checks and balances where you know she rubs her tits in the guy's face. If he sticks out his tongue while that's happening, he's going to get reprimanded. But that doesn't stop that man from still objectifying that woman and saying about her that she's a slut, she's a whore, because he didn't get what he wanted. She was too tantalizing. Why isn't she going that extra step further? Because the business aspect is lost. When you're in that burlesque show, what you're seeing up on stage, it's kind of like a theater of the bizarre. You're in a different world of laughing about it, but you're also noticing that there are these very stereotypical kind of roles that these women are dressed up like a housewife, looks like they just got done vacuuming the home, and then they start, dancing around a chair, and when it's all said and done, you're not necessarily saying, I mean, certainly there are hot burlesque women, but you're not necessarily always like, yeah, I'm now going to, break that threshold between her being up on stage and performing and me, thinking that I've got a chance with her. That transaction may happen backstage or offstage or whatever, but in terms of the show itself, the show isn't accessible to the man in the audience. The man in the audience merely watches as an observer of the female figure, watches her strip, and of course, they're usually never fully naked, so that in and of itself is a tease, but the man is never teased to that point where he will then say, what a slut. He will say, that's artistic, that's wonderful, fun show, or unless he's just a pig, he's going to say, well, what the fuck, where were my tits? But in terms of the actual strip club, those guys are going in there, and my girlfriend and I were at a strip club about two or three weeks ago here in Detroit. It's one of the worst in the world. I mean, it's just, if you want to talk about the commodification of women, that's where you want to go to see that happen. And we were standing there, and you can just feel it permeating in the air as a man walking in there, especially a man who is spoken for. I go in there, and I'm not necessarily, I have no desire for these women. I'm going in there, for that purely aesthetic reason. And so my girlfriend and I are sitting there, but you see these lecherous gentlemen, I can't even call them that, and certainly their motives for being there are less than sincere when it comes to, are they there just to be the other end of this business transaction? No. A lot of these guys honestly think they have a shot. And you see it because you can see the trap, you can see their faces, you can see their soul crumble when that stripper stops paying attention to them sometimes. Or when the woman comes and sits down and they don't want that shot of that, that vial of high C ecto cooler or whatever it is they put in there, and they don't want to buy it. She moves on to the next guy. You can kind of see the hurt. There's a difference. And I think burlesque is just, it's a matter of classy versus just what a strip club is. And burlesque, I will say, hands down, is a much bigger turn-on for me. And it's also a lot more fun to watch. You can sit there and laugh about it the whole time, but you can also find some attraction to it. And when I'm at a club, I'm uncomfortable. At a strip club, last time I was there too, it was me, my girlfriend, this guy she was in a show with recently, a play, and his girlfriend. And we were standing there, and this this guy, he looked like your typical, you know, he was drunk out of his mind, he was a jock. He kind of reminded me of Private Pyle in Full Metal Jacket, that's Vincent D'Onofrio's character, in the way that he had this thousand-yard stare where he would look at you, and he was staring, evaluating my girlfriend, and this other gentleman, his name is Kevin, his girlfriend, and he actually had the balls to come up to Kevin's girlfriend and say to her, "How much for a lap dance? I'll give you $10. And she said, "No, I'm spoken for. I'm not a dancer," which was quite obvious by the turtleneck she was wearing. and he was like, $10, you know, come on. She said, "No." And then he said it again, and Kevin's like, "No, she's not going to strip for you." And he's like, "What, you speak for her now?" And he's like, "No, she told you twice already that she's not going to dance for you." And all it took was Kevin standing less than 5 inches away from her, but not touching her totally, for that douchebag to think that that woman was available. That climate was only bred because he was in that strip club and felt as though he was owed something.
Exactly. It's illustrative of what a strip club creates and sort of sells to men's minds, and that's that a women's sexuality is can always be bought. You know, that women are only looking for a man's dollar. You know, because a man is the only one capable of making money. So it's all about the money and selling sex for money. And then men get in there, and the whole economy that's going on there convinces them that this is how the world is. This is how every woman is. They're all available, and the strippers are sort of protecting this conception by feeding it. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that I will show you everything, do whatever you want for your money. Sure, you're never going to truly get me, but that's not nearly as dangerous as the complete idea that they're putting into every guy's mind, which is completely at work in a strip club, you know, and in a burlesque show that's totally not at work. There's always this huge distance, and that the theatrical performance is plotted out and completely planned. You know, it's appropriating certain images, mixing certain images, creating these sort of pastiches of the domestic and the sexual, you know, but it's never at the command of the man via his money, and that's the important part.
You know, it's interesting, because one of the things about strip clubs in the States, depends on which state you're in or which locality you're in, because each one has a different law on how close you can be to a stripper. Here in Detroit, you can put your face in between a stripper's tits. She can wrap her legs around you. She can't be pantless, though. She has to have her panties on, no matter what. It's only topless here. We were just in Toronto, though, my girlfriend and I, and we decided to step into a strip club, which was great because there was no cover, which was awesome, and it was smoke-free, so there was no, like, you know, smoke enveloping us as we went in. And we sat down, and what was different there was that you can have no panties, no top, so it's full nudity, but there's a separate stage that is totally inaccessible to men who are sitting in the booths. There's an aisleway in between where patrons walk, but nobody is allowed to stand there. Everyone sits at the table, they watch this woman strip completely nude, but there is no money exchanging hands. I don't know how it works there, if they get paid a flat rate, if they get some percentage of how much comes into the house during the span of their show, how that works, but we sat there and we were kind of in awe because the women here in Detroit have to really work for their money. Because the more tit you show, or the more you rub in a guy's face, or the more that a guy just desires you based on your predisposition to great features, you know, that's how much money you take home. Obviously, that's capitalism at work. But in Canada, when you're up on that stage, you've got your 5 minutes or two songs or whatever it is. You dance your first song typically without stripping much. Your second song, you go fully nude. You do your routine. There was a few girls that night who were really good at it. They were really good dancers. But in the end, they just walk off stage, collect their garments, and that's that. At no point did a man have his hand, you know, going into her bra or her panties. It was quite a strange sight to see, but it turns the convention that we're talking about upside down, because here is a regular strip club where I know these Canadian men were definitely desiring these women. The difference was is that they showed their desire by clapping loud at the end. Mm-hmm. It was very different.
In my pockets on the Alhambra shore. The next topic was a really quick one. You know, I have, for some reason, I have a lot of people, a lot of times, you know, get in conversations with, you know, what's your top, you know, five movies? What's your top five TV shows?
Bottle Rocket.
You know, or, you know, what's your, you know, what's your worst five, you know, movies you've ever seen? Somebody just asked me that a while ago, and I couldn't come up with any. And then, but I was sitting watching TV, and I was, you know, and this was always in the back of my head, what are, you know, the worst movies, the worst TV shows ever? And I finally came up with one that's on my list. And this
TV show or movie?
TV show. I finally discovered one that is hands down one of my least favorite TV shows of all time. And that is Celebrity Deathmatch. I fucking hate Celebrity Deathmatch on MTV, where they have claymation celebrities fight each other amidst the worst comedy writing to have ever hit the airwaves, next to maybe Empty Nest. I mean, has anyone ever watched an episode of Celebrity Deathmatch and laughed?
No.
Ever! It's impossible. You watch it, and it is impossible to laugh at that show. And I'm not exactly sure why. I think it's because the whole concept of the show is completely unappealing. I don't care about seeing hypothetical matchups between Eminem and fucking Kid Rock. I don't care.
That show gained traction in the late 90s. It was, I didn't even know it was still on until
MTV 2.
Okay, see, I didn't even know that was still going on, because I remember maybe in high school seeing Marilyn Manson versus Rose McGowan or whatever. I don't know what it was. And the like, what the attraction was as a younger person, not to say that I didn't like it back then either, but I'm saying if I stayed tuned for that extra minute, it was to see, like, what kind of gore are they going to feature in this? Are they going to have somebody come in with a chainsaw and, you know, that was the only thing. And that's just out of boredom.
But
that's
because
not out of interest.
But because it's claymation, the gore, for some reason, isn't even interesting. It's not like a movie. I think because it's claymation, it just... I just don't care.
Yeah, it's you're right. It's one of the worst shows on TV. I think my problem with that assessment is that I just didn't know it was still on anymore. If this were 1998, I would say certainly that's one of the worst shows on TV. But there's got to be something. There's got to be some show on TV right now that when you turn through the channels, you see that on and you immediately flick away, or you watch it because it's such a train wreck. And what would that show be?
Well, the thing about Celebrity Deathmatch is I can't sit through more than 2 minutes of it. And that's hard for me to say for almost every other show on TV right now.
What about it's on MTV One, on the regular MTV, what about that Yo Mama show?
I've sat through more than 2 minutes of that show.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so bad. All right, what about... Pretty much every show I can think of right now is on MTV.
Yeah, MTV has to be one of the worst creators and producers of television programming. They do it in such a way that, you know, all the shows they come up with, it's got to be some sort of economic scheme wherein they know they can trick people in for one season to just watching it and sort of feeling it out and make a profit on it, because those shows never come back for a second season.
Hey, look, I'm guilty of the MTV bug, because I watched Laguna Beach, the first season, religiously. Me and my old roommate, Mike McKinney, who listens to this podcast, we would sit down, and on many nights, we would be like, all right, what's on? We'd see Laguna Beach, we'd be like, fuck yeah, we'd get some beers, we'd watch Laguna Beach, wonder what was going on with Lauren,
LC.
LC is Lauren. LC or fucking Kristen or whoever it was. And we were kind of interested, but it was because it was a train wreck of a show, not because we were that invested. Well, we were invested, I guess, but it was a train wreck of a show. Now, the second season, I guess, which is what's on now, it's absolutely horrific, because the kids on that show are trying to be cooler or different, but they just all look like retards. And when I say retards, I mean actual mentally retarded human beings. And it's a horrible show on TV. I can't say that that's my least favorite show on TV. I'm trying to think if there is a show right now on TV that when I flip by, I cannot keep it on for, like, as soon as I see it, I turn it.
You know, you just helped me figure out exactly why I hate Celebrity Deathmatch.
Oh, thank you.
A show like Laguna Beach is a crappy show, but it can be interesting because it has a narrative. And then a show like Deal or No Deal, which is probably one of the crappiest game shows ever.
Oh, that's the worst.
But it's still a game show, so there's something inherent in it that there's something interesting in it because there's a game being played, there's money being played for.
There's something at stake.
Yeah, okay, but Celebrity Deathmatch neither has narrative nor is a game show.
Yeah,
it's completely and utterly pointless. There's no investment. It's completely and utterly pointless, and that's why it's one of the worst shows ever made.
I agree with that. And you know what? Even if you're a fan of Claymation, you can get your fix elsewhere. So
yeah, the California Raisin Christmas special.
Exactly. So you're all set on that.
That was a great Claymation show. Do you remember that?
Yeah. But, oh, God, yeah. I used to have the California Raisins kids book. It was like a... I don't even remember what the adventure was inside of that, but yeah, California Raisins. It was also because it was on Saturday mornings as part of the cartoon lineup, even though it wasn't a cartoon.
I can't believe that we consumed that as kids. Talking raisins. That's saying Motown. Which is funny because they're like, hey, Motown people are black. California Raisins are black.
Well, wasn't their song, like, I Heard It Through the Grapevine? Wasn't that the song that they kind of, like, would sing?
Yeah, that was their signature song.
Yeah, which was stupid. But really quickly, before we get off this topic, I need to bring up a movie that, for some reason, on IMDb, it's only got a 6.6, but it was nominated for Oscars in its time. And maybe your mom was a fan of this because she seems like the type. But Katie and I watched it on Saturday night after everything was closed in Toronto, because Toronto closes at fucking 10 o'clock on a Saturday night because there's no liquor stores. It's just the liquor store, and you can't get liquor from there after 10 on Saturday. So we were just hanging out in our hotel room eating za, which was about mediocre in the first place. And the only thing on TV was this movie called The Rose, starring Bette Midler. And I don't know if your mom ever watched this when you were younger. You, like I said, she seems like the kind of person who would.
No, I've never heard of it.
It's basically this film that's kind of sort of modeled on the life of Janis Joplin, but not really.
Oh, yeah, I know this movie. Yeah, my mom watched it.
See, I knew it. I knew it. And it features some of the worst music, and it's all about, like, I mean, it's, by all accounts, it's more music than fucking dialogue. And so all you get to hear is Bette Midler, who, yeah, she's a good singer. I'm not going to take it away from her. But all it is her being like, yeah.
Well, that's Janis Joplin.
Crazy. Sure. Okay, that's fine. I don't give a fuck, though. And you know what? Don't show it on regular TV anymore. If somebody is a fan of this film, this is one of those films that can die gracefully, and it can also be bought only by those people who were alive in 1979. And then they can expose it to people of our generation. That's fine. But to tell you the truth, I really don't want to deal with this film ever again in my life. We sat there and watched it, and I remember after an hour of it, I looked at my girlfriend, and I said, Katie, what the hell are we doing right now? Why are we watching this film? Nothing has happened except for she's taken more pills, she's gone up on stage at some fucking country club and sang this bullshit rock and roll that isn't rock and roll. It's like the worst rock and roll you can imagine.
You could destroy Bette Midler's whole filmography, and I mean, the world would be, you know, worse. I mean, Bette Midler has never done anything worth anything.
Well, let's take a look at it real quick.
There's gonna be nothing there. She's horrible.
The one film I see right now is Murph. Is Get Shorty, which I liked back in the day. However, here's a few of the key ingredients to her shitty film career. Ruthless People. My mom and dad watched that in '86. I don't want to ever see that film ever again in my fucking life. Beaches. You saw it as a family outing. Don't deny it.
it was to date the worst movie going experience I've ever had.
Okay, so there's that. Hocus Pocus. If you were a kid in 1993, you know that film featured just a bunch of, you know, snot-nosed, big bump on the bridge of their nose women. And I didn't want to deal with any of those ladies either. Okay, The First Wives Club. Anyone seen it? Do I hear crickets? Okay. And then she was on Murphy Brown for one episode. That speaks volumes, because nobody goes on Murphy Brown and their career survives. Nobody. Drowning Mona was her next horrible film. And then she was on her own hit sitcom, which wasn't quite a hit because it was called Bet. And that movie, or that sitcom failed, and now apparently she's in a couple new films in 2007, and let's hope to Christ that those fail miserably. Bette Midler, please die. Slip me across this world. Let's save the planet.
Can't wait another day. I did something a couple weekends ago that I thought was going to totally suck. I went on one of those celebrity tours in Hollywood, you know, where you go on the bus.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be horrible. But I went because my girlfriend and her roommate wanted to go. And then my girlfriend had been on one of these before, and she's like, they're really great, you know, you'll like it. And I was like, yeah, right, whatever, I'm going to hate this. So I get on the tour, and it was just a tiny van, I guess, with this guy. And this guy, I guess, was featured in Los Angeles Magazine and stuff. He's like the best tour guide. And he was one of those guys who was totally gay, but actually was straight, you know?
Right.
And he was way into Hollywood and knew incredible amounts of information about everything. So we get on this tour, and it was actually really, really fun. Like, I was amazed at how fun it was. And just what he does is, you know, you get in the van and you just drive around and, you know, he's got so much information in his head that he can point out every street corner, something that happened on there. Like, oh, that's where Brad Pitt was outside El Pollo Loco before he was famous and blah, blah, blah. You know, we went up to the motel that Janis Joplin died in, and he had actually stayed in her room as a birthday present, and he pointed out the exact room that she died in and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so awesome. And we went, have you ever seen Blowout on Bravo with the hairdresser?
No. I haven't.
Jonathan Anton or whatever?
Yes, I know it.
Yeah, we go by his salon, and he's like, this is Jonathan Anton's salon. We stop there, and then all of a sudden Jonathan Anton appears out of the window and is like waving, and the bus driver goes completely nuts. He's like, oh my God! Oh, Jonathan, I love you! He's like, our bus driver's like hanging out the window. Being so gay. But the long story short, I highly recommend anyone who visits Hollywood to go on one of these tours. The Starline, like, Hollywood tour, it takes like 2 hours, and it's actually incredibly fun, and it's cool seeing celebrities' homes. And, you know, it's odd because you go down in Hollywood proper, and it's like a slum almost, you know, and you see all the proletariat. And then you venture up into the hills, and it's a whole completely other world of magnificent, ridiculous, you know, wealth that is just hard to even fathom. And it really makes you see, it illustrates perfectly the fact that in this country we have a disgusting gap that is just getting worse and worse between these people who live up in the hills in these houses that are ludicrous. And then everyone else down below, like it's unbelievable. So that's a high, big recommendation for me.
Well, maybe next time my girlfriend and I are out there, we'll try that out.
Yeah, I mean, I anyone would love it. It's not just for people who read Star Magazine and stuff.
Is there a website for that guy so you can plug him?
His name's Brian Donnelly, and he said to request it.
We're getting kind of late in this podcast, and we had three more topics, but here's the thing. I have to brush up on my Battlestar Galactica before we can really discuss not just the episode, but also its correlations with the Iraq War and the insurgency more specifically. And I could discuss that right now, but really I want to watch the last two episodes before I say anything on it.
Well, let me say this. That these first episodes were the best episodes ever, I think. It was their best story arc ever. Which is a pretty amazing thing considering how great the first two seasons have already been. And that this show keeps getting better. That's all I'll say right now, though.
Okay. And I can see that that's the trajectory it's on. And let me also say this right now, because I don't know what the fucking deal is. You know, there's people out there who... When you say, like, hey, I've been watching this really good show, you gotta check it out. And then they're like, oh, what show is it? most people, you know, they expect you to be like, oh, it's one of those legal shows that are on TV. and then everyone's like, oh, yeah, I'll check it out. Or it's this doctor show. Or it's this really hip, cool new show. It's kind of like Friends, but it's not Friends. When I tell you, you got to check out Battlestar Galactica, please do not look me in the face and call me a fucking nerd. please don't say to me, oh, sci-fi, because this just in, and it's on all the fucking advertisements, Rolling Stone magazine, which is not a nerd's magazine, Rolling Stone show to be the best show on television still. That still means it was before and it still is. And what I'm trying to tell people is, if I tell you that Battlestar Galactica is sweet, just check it out and eschew all of your sentiments about science fiction, because you can watch the show and not be a fan of sci-fi.
I know.
And yet still be immersed in the fact that there is sci-fi, but you're unknowingly loving the show. Listen, I'm a fan of science fiction, so yeah. No, as a rational human being who loves science fiction, I can recognize great science fiction. This is it. But if you're not a sci-fi lover, if you're not at all, if you just love good character dramas, if you love storylines that take you on this emotional roller coaster between all these different characters, meaning, you know, from the most lowly ensign on a ship to the admiral of an entire fleet, if that makes you excited, like, watch the show and be excited about it, because you don't have to give a shit about space, one of the things that happens in it, but that's certainly not the most integral aspect of the show. That show is a character study, and it takes all these different characters, it takes the involvement of human interaction, and it weaves into this entirely different, altogether new story that you have never seen on TV before. So the next time I tell you, please watch Battlestar Galactica, don't retreat to your recesses of your brain that makes you go into this high school mode that says, nerds watch that, I watch, you know, the fucking, you know, WCW wrestling. Go back, you know, and actually think to yourself, wait, I do like good television. And then say, well, Chris likes good television as well. Battlestar must be good television. Watch it. You've got to fucking watch it. Start from the miniseries, go straight forward from there. You'll never regret it. Best decision of your life next to, you know, having an abortion.
There's no doubt in my mind that if cable and sci-fi weren't as stigmatized as they are in the public imaginary and in the critics' imaginary, the critics aren't these amazing people that sit up on high and can give completely unimpeded value judgments on all television. They're also affected by these things too. And there's no doubt in my mind that if those stigmas weren't in place, Battlestar would be universally considered to be the single best show airing on television right now.
Agreed.
Because, you know, Sopranos, I guess Sopranos and Lost would probably be in that category right now in most critics' minds. I have watched both Sopranos and Lost. They are not half as good as Battlestar in any one of the capacities that a show should be judged on.
I agree. My roommate was an avid Lost fan. I tried to get into it. And, yeah, okay, it's not a bad show. I'm not going to say
it's not a bad show.
And if I was there from the beginning, maybe, you know, I would be into it right now, and that's fine. And maybe if I watched the episodes, I'd be fine. But the difference is very clear. This Battlestar Galactica is way more, it's way more intricate. It has so much more to it than any show I've really ever seen on television. And that's saying a lot, because you only have an hour to pack this kind of stuff into an episode, and they've chosen strategically how to do it with each episode to make you want more. I remember at the end of season 2, I think it was, just before this season, I was screaming at my television, and I know you hear people talk about that. I sat through the Growing Pains series finale, okay? When Mike Seaver carves his name on the brick behind the picture of the Seavers. And I did not scream for that show like I did for season 3 of Battlestar Galactica.
What was that ending of? That was the series ending of Growing Pains?
The series ending of Growing Pains was they were moving out of the house that they had been in since whatever year that show started.
Yeah.
And it ended with the mother, I can't think of her name, but the mother.
Yeah.
Its last item in the house was, you know, during the intro, there's the show me that smile again.
Yeah.
And it's the last shot is this, like, framed picture of them. And so the last shot of the series in the finale is her taking that last thing of the house, that last piece of you know, whatever they had left in the house, she removes the picture, and behind it, on a brick, behind it, on the mantle, says, Mike Seaver was here. Fade to black.
Oh, man, that's a great ending.
That was sad. I cried. I did cry, but I did not say, why can't we have one more season? Battlestar, I said firmly last season, I said, fuck, motherfuck, shit, cunt, fuck, motherfuck, and I did that my TV. And I was pissed because I needed it.
Okay, wait. It's getting to 40 minutes. I've got one more thing to say because time is of the essence with this announcement. There is a new show on television called Heroes. I know, it looks gay. I thought it looked gay. Everyone thought it looked gay. It's about people that get superpowers, ordinary people. I was fully under the impression this show was horrible. And then last night they had a sort of a marathon on. So I'm watching the marathon, I missed the first episode, so I'm on the second episode. And I'm like, this is actually kind of good. You know, I was getting into it. So the show ends, lo and behold, it's written by perhaps the third greatest comic book writer of all time, Jeff Loeb, who wrote The Long Halloween and one other epic Batman story I can't remember. I mean, he's easily one of the best. He writes some of the most complicated, dramatic, like just beautiful comic book stories. And here he's now writing and executive producing this show called Heroes. I watched the rest of the episodes they had on the marathon. It's great. If you know comic books, it's like a cross between Watchmen and X-Men. The ending of the last episode was so badass. It was sort of one of the coolest, like, badass moments in a show I've seen in quite a while. It's no Battlestar, but it's close. You know, it'll tide you over. It's on Mondays at, like, I think 9 p.m., and it's got my next highest recommendation to Battlestar. It's that cool.
So. Wow. I did not expect that, because I've seen this show on TV, and it's one of those shows, when I saw it, I thought to myself, I really don't want to try to invest in it, because I doubt it's any good.
I know, but it is, because it's written by a comic book guy, so it's not like, oh, look at how wacky it is that these people got powers. You can tell that he's weaving a plot within a plot. I mean, it's got sort of a murder mystery inside of it. It's got, one guy can time travel, and I'll just talk about the last episode. So there's this guy who's got roguelike powers that when he's around people, he saps their powers. So, like, when he's around his brother who can fly, he can fly. And he originally thought that he could just fly, but now we're starting to find out that he can sap powers. So he's on this subway at the end of the last episode, and there's this, like, really nerdy Japanese guy in Tokyo that found out he can time travel. So we're following his story as he's journeying through the United States because he's got this prophetic comic book by this guy who can see the future and shit, and he's going to his destiny or whatever. And he's super nerdy and just, like, horribly weak. So the guy who can sap powers is on a subway doing his own thing. All of a sudden, time stops in the subway. And the guy's like, what in the hell is going on? So he's walking around the subway, and then you hear these ominous steps up on the rooftop. And it's like all freaky. And you know someone's coming, you think it's going to be a villain, because there are sort of villains in this story. And all of a sudden, this guy emerges out of the shadows. And he's like, I don't reckon... He goes to the guy who's sort of stopped in the subway. He's like, I don't recognize you without that scar on your face. And he's like, what the hell are you talking about? Scar on my face. He's like, don't worry about it. You know, I know who you are. He's like, my name's Hero or whatever. And he sort of steps out of the shadow. And you can tell it's that nerdy Japanese guy, but he's all of a sudden a badass. And it's him from the future coming to find this guy who he knows in the future, because apparently maybe they started some superhero group or something.
Whoa.
It was such a badass moment. I was just blown away at how cool it was.
Let me give you my prediction of this show. Canceled.
Yeah, I know.
it's gonna end. This kind of show does not exist on regular TV or cable.
I know. I immediately thought that last night. I was like, this is going to be canceled. And because I know Jeff Loeb, he probably has this whole story plotted out for at least 3 seasons.
Right.
So the payoff, I mean, the show is really going to start probably at the end of season 2.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing him, and it's not even going to make it there, I bet.
No.
So...
It's, it's so unfortunate because American TV is so cluttered with bullshit, and this is the kind of show that's going to fall through the cracks. And I guess it said here on the trivia, the premiere episode on ABC attracted 14.3 million viewers overall and received the highest rating for any NBC drama premiere in 5 years. And it's on Sci-Fi Channel now, right?
No, this is on Network. And the thing is
it's not on Sci-Fi.
Well, maybe they're playing it on both.
Okay.
I don't know, but what I would say is start watching it as soon as possible. It's going to be confusing as hell, but if you go on TV.com, they have sort of synopsis of the story, so read over those and just try to jump in and catch it now.
Okay.
I mean, it's really something really worth watching because it's a comic book TV show that isn't, like, stupid like The Flash. So.
Or Mantis.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a perfect time to segue not only into an ending, but also and I have this idea, and we want to know who's with us or against us. We're going to start a comic book store that's also a gaming shop, and we need your help. If you want to start this up with us, if you have the capital to help, or if you just have the manpower, let us know, send us an email, and say, look, I'm not only into comics, D&D, being a geek, gaming it up on a fucking Friday night when everyone else is out clubbing and taking their ecstasy. I want to be drinking brews, becoming a fucking warrior on a fantasy playing field. That's your gimmick? You call us up. You dial our internet number, which is chris@the-means.com or tanner@the-means.com. Let us know, and we will incorporate you into this new grand scheme we have to become the owners of the most badass comic book store of all time. Tell them a few of the key ingredients, Tanner.
Well, first of all, this person needs $1 million.
Yeah. So don't...
Do we really have the time to go into this?
Just tell them a few of the key ingredients.
The key ingredients is it's going to be well lit. It's not going to feel like a cave full of dusty comic books.
There will not be white walls filled with bins, like, next to which there are bins full of comic books that you have to slave through to find a single fucking comic that you want.
It's going to have both superhero and alternative.
Alternative featured on the in the front window as well, because we don't want people thinking that all we sell is... I mean, my personal favorite is the Green Lantern, but we don't want them thinking that that's all we sell is the Green Lantern. We want people to think that you can buy, you know... comic books that are written by girls that are penned and inked by women who have valid ideas within the comic book world. We want to make sure that everyone
and who are also hot.
And yeah, they have to be hot. My girlfriend was kind of upset when I told her that at the last there were some hot girls who did some comics. So she said she definitely has to accompany me to this one. But it's true, there's hot comic book artists out there. A lot of nerds don't know that. I'm just saying. So anyway, our point is, we have ambitions, okay? And we want to make sure that we fulfill those dreams. And if you want to help us do that, please do, because we don't have means.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll be on a podcast next week. We got to start doing this regularly.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we'll lose our fan base of 7 people. So, Carl, Mike, Broly, Mom, Dad.
Keep listening.
Keep listening, and we'll get back to you next week. Or we'll talk to you in the... And you can just listen to all the shit that we recycle back into this. Shit.
Oh, the sad truth.
All right, watch Battlestar Galactica Friday night at 9.
You have been listening to This Just In, recorded on Monday, October 23rd, and distributed on Tuesday, October 24th. For more information, please visit www.the-means.com. Also, Issue 2 should be coming out. We can't give you a definitive date, they'll probably be shipping within the next couple weeks, so sit tight. It'll be worth the wait.
Save the planet, I can't wait another day.